Steve, thanks very much for that great overview. Yeah, we are going to be hearing from Rich Plappin, not yet. And I want to thank Steve for that great overview and giving us a sense of the trajectory of efforts on assessing safety and effectiveness in the full range of medical products and how surveillance can well be a catalyst for moving these efforts towards better evidence forward. Now we are going to hear from Rachel Sherman, who, Steve is new to the FDA but has been making contributions across this spectrum of better scientific evidence for throughout his career. Rachel has been doing some of the same but through a distinguished career at the FDA. She's now the Associate Director of Medical Policy at the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research at the FDA. And in this critical position at CDER, Rachel oversees a range of medical policy programs and cross-cutting initiatives on clinical trials, on human subjects protections, on good clinical practices, very importantly, leading the efforts on the Sentinel Initiative implementation. So, Rachel, if you could come on up, thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm only 5'1", so maybe I should. Is that better? Good morning and welcome. First of all, on behalf of the agency, as Dr. Spielberg did, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for coming. I'm actually quite delighted to see that our numbers have not decreased from last year, just sort of glancing around, which I think speaks to the interest in this effort. I'd also like to once again thank our colleagues at Brookings, and there's Dr. Temple, and your seat is right here, Dr. Temple. who, and during a period of change in Brookings, have managed to put together two complex and very important meetings in the period of a month for us. So once again, thank you for all your support. And again, recognize our partner in crime, our colleagues at Harvard, Rich Platt and his crew. They're our contractors, but they're really our colleagues, as well as our federal partners. I never use slides following Mark because he usually says everything I have to say, but I'm not ever sure. And Steve has filled in most of the other points, so I'm just going to mention a couple of broad policy comments that I would like to make. Rich and Bob Temple, who is making his way to seat, are going to be giving you the meat of the progress to date. And this is our fourth annual meeting. We promised you an annual meeting, and with Brookings' help through our cooperative agreement, in fact, we have kept that promise. And we think, very exciting. Today is going to be particularly exciting because there's an enormous amount of progress, not only that we've made, but results, things that we're actually doing. We can talk more not just about infrastructure, but actually about results, about reviewers using the functionality, and a little bit about our trajectory forward. And I think that what that reflects, I like to say that we're ahead of schedule and under budget. Of course, we had no particular schedule and no particular budget, so that's a little bit easy to claim. But in fact, it's true. We started out with a very vague few lines in an Amendments Act, and really under General Cook's leadership, decided to do what needed to be done, not just what we were instructed to do. We've done and accomplished that, and you'll be hearing some of that from Rich, but do what needed to be done in terms of addressing the critical needs for evidence generation, in this case in safety. But I think what I'd like to point out is that the lessons learned in our approach is broadly applicable, not only to safety efforts and to where Sentinel may go in the future, but also to other policy initiatives. So the first point I'd like to make, and this is an important point to the agency, it may sound very, very specific. I don't want to say arcane, but for the first time in the history of the agency, we are outsourcing a core function. We've never done that before, which makes us very nervous about Rich's health and the health of Harvard. But it speaks to the point that in this day and age, we can no longer and should no longer assume or try to do everything in-house. There's too much expertise outside in this world that we can tap, that we can make use of, and we shouldn't and can't hire into the agency. The reason a Sentinel, I will again claim, is ahead of schedule and under budget is because we have been, with an enormous amount of help from our federal partners, from our contractors at Harvard, from Brookings, been able to establish a coalition of the willing, the able, the knowledgeable, OMOP, various privacy experts, and so forth. And that allowed us to move very, very quickly. And we did this in the absence of what most people would perceive as a tangible threat. The other example, at least in my FDA career, that I can think of where this happened, where everyone came together, was at the beginning of the HIV epidemic. And I think the country at large saw that as a tangible threat. We do have a huge threat facing us. I won't discuss healthcare economics. That's Mark's department. But we have a tremendous lack of evidence in terms of what patients and physicians need to know every time they make a treatment decision and choice. And we as a country can't afford to, one, not develop the evidence, and two, to develop it in a very expensive way. Thus, the interest in secondary use. And Sentinel is living proof that with imperfect evidence and emerging methodologies, we've learned an enormous amount already in terms of research on methods about what to do with these data, but there's a lot we don't know. So with an emerging methodology and imperfect data, we can already learn a lot. So how did we get where we are as quickly as we have, and where should we go with it? Well, it's by constantly asking ourselves two questions. What brings each sector to the table, and what keeps them to the table? Because when one acts as a collaboration, as a consortium, as a partnership, we all give up some autonomy, we give up some of what we want, we gain a lot in return. But if we don't understand the pain points and we don't understand the priorities, then we do start losing people. And I think one thing that's been absolutely critical, obviously, is transparency. And it's another thing that's been equally critical to the transparency is thinking about the what is achievable. First of all, what are the hardest things? What might, if you will, kill us? Or, as I used to think as an intern and a resident, what do I need to do that's dependent on other people? The easy stuff I can do later to get the patient admitted. What do I have to do first? If it's the chest x-ray, let me do that first because I'm going to have to, in the olden days anyway, go dig around for it. So we did the hardest stuff first. In our case, that was the privacy and security. We're still struggling with conflict of interest. That's turning to be a bit of a sticking point. Do the hardest stuff first. Do biteable pieces. Manage expectations. Sentinel, as we said over and over and over again, I'm looking for Melissa because it's her punchline. Melissa Robb, who's really actually kept all this going. It's one tool in the toolbox. There's not going to be a Sentinel answer. Sentinel is not a panacea. Sentinel is yet another way to generate information that will help us understand medical products, all medical products, as Dr. Spielberg pointed out. But in developing that tool in that toolbox and adding to the information, we have to manage expectations, and those, particularly those that pay our bills, the U.S. Congress, have to understand that Sentinel alone will not solve the evidence problems facing this country. So as we move forward, I mean, we are here today to say Sentinel, mini Sentinel, whatever you want to call it, the FDA-owned and operated portion is up and running and functioning. It's not doing everything it can do. There's a lot more we want to do. We have several difficult horizons ahead of us. The question is, can we move beyond FDA? We believe we should. FDA is not going to own and operate that, but we believe we should. We developed a functionality that has been paid for by public dollars, and we think should be accessible to as many who can profit from it. One important stakeholder that we've tried to keep at the table but thus far can't make use of this tool is industry, so that's something for us to think about. The second, obviously, is transparency. We are committed to, and I believe have posted result. We will post all results. Results means that something is finished. It will go up. That's not an answer. There's no Sentinel answer. I believe that staff is going to talk about that a little bit later. But what we know, we want the public to know. We believe one can argue about what should happen to the results of human experimentation, whether it should ever be kept confidential, but certainly these data developed in the partnership, secondary use of people's healthcare information, will be made public. And then the third point I wanted to make, and this is an election season, in case no one's noticed. And it's a PDUFA cycle, which is an interesting sort of tsunami of events. And there's been a lot, or there's been some discussion, maybe a lot of discussion about the 1962 efficacy amendments, which one could argue provided one of the greatest incentives ever for evidence generation. So the question is, other efforts at evidence generation, can we and those that are involved that learn from Sentinel? And I think the answer is yes. Go slow, be very careful, choose your partners wisely, don't exclude anyone, and take biteable pieces. But at the end of the day, remember that patients and physicians, we all need to better understand how to use the therapies available. And it's through coalitions such as this, and secondary use is one of the important sources of affordable healthcare information that we as a country will move forward in providing better care for patients and improving human health. So again, thank you for coming, and we look forward to a very interesting day. Thanks.
Let's get Rachel to take a seat. We're gonna we have some time now, as I mentioned earlier, for questions and discussions for Rachel, and this is a good time if you have, if there's anything you want to know about the implementation of Sentinel from the FDA perspective, this is a good time to bring up those questions. Again, we've got a microphone at microphones on both sides of the room. When you are ready to ask a question, please come on up, and I'll try to go back and forth between the two microphones. So let me get a start over here. And please be sure to identify who you are, where you're from.
Yes, hi, I'm Paul Watkins from the Hamner University of North Carolina Institute for Drug Safety Sciences. And I just want to point out that Sentinel is an extraordinary opportunity to go beyond signal detection and actually really learn a lot of things. So there are many examples now where if you have one of these rare adverse events, the most important piece of information is actually whether that individual contains certain genetic variants. And that's actually more valuable in making the diagnosis than knowing the dose of the drug, the duration, the age, any other variable you can think of. So even in signal detection, the ability to go back to the individual and get DNA is important. In addition, there are now several examples where companies, after seeing rare adverse events in the real world, have gone back to stored DNA and looked at genetic associations with milder but similar events, many largely overlooked, found strong genetic associations that they can then go forward and test and see are in these more severe events, and then actually have a personalized medicine strategy to go forward. And then lastly, obviously, if we really understood the mechanisms why these rare people have these events, we could be smarter, we could design better drugs. And it isn't just genetics now. The technology exists to take blood cells, make what are called induced pluripotent stem cells, and actually recreate the organ of toxicity in a petri dish to really study it. So I think it would be a shame if this were only signal detection. My question is this being considered in the actual structure of the Sentinel Initiative now?
Well, I could just say yes and leave it at that, but that wouldn't be fun. So I'll start with, Mark made 3 points about it was a distributed network, we were doing queries, and we were leaving, you know, aggregate data. And that, those sounded very simple. Those were huge struggles. Why is that a part in part answer for your question? Because this our, or my standard line is the Sentinel of today is not the Sentinel of 5 years from now, the Sentinel of 25 years from now. People have heard that. Yes, but we knew, and we decided, and I think we've been proven correct, that we have to bite off one piece at a time. The functionalities you're describing are very ambitious and probably we would hope would be part of a larger effort, initiative, staying away from the word system because that makes it sound like an IT system, that would involve multiple stakeholders and be governed probably outside the FDA. So definitely we believe we are a catalyst and that our success is will help catalyze moving forward towards that. We are engaged with Brookings and others in the discussions about how to move that along. And we will do as much as we can from our end. Some of that we could eventually probably do from the FDA. I'm looking at my boss, depending on how much money she gives us. And some of that we would need a much larger consortium to do.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Over here.
Hi. Vinit Nair from Humana, one of the Mini Sentinel partners. I was very intrigued by your comment that Mini Sentinel is one of the tools. And being naive of the rest of the toolbox that the FDA has, would you feel a little comfortable commenting on, is there an interrelationship between Sentinel and these other tools? Do you see any kind of connectivities that you can describe?
Okay, so I know Judy Staff is here, so she may want to comment after. So as a former reviewer, okay, what do I have available to me when I'm worried about a product? Well, I have the pre-market database. I have any post-market studies that are going on. I have AIRS. I now have Mini Sentinel. I'm sure I'm going to be in contact with a company to find out if they have anything that we at the FDA don't have. That's what I meant by tool in the toolbox, various sources of data. I can think of very few examples where one of those sources provides the answer. Aggregated together, they give us a pretty good idea of what to think. I know, I don't know exactly where Judy is or whether someone else from FDA wants to comment, but Judy's giving me a thumbs up, so I think I got it right.
Rachel, on a related point, do you want to comment on how you see the relationship between phase four studies that companies might be required to undertake and Sentinel Emerging? I know you talked a little bit earlier about how this infrastructure might potentially be used by industry at some point.
Yep. Well, as you know, we're thinking a lot about that. Who gets to use it? Who the Sentinel functionality, and who pays for it? And one other point, that currently, because Harvard Pilgrim is acting under contract to us, they are acting under our public health authorities, and that provides, it streamlines a lot of processes. So I think the answer is not known. I think in a perfect world, every interested party, and the companies are certainly a very interested party. One, they know, have unique knowledge about their products, and two, they have a responsibility, we believe, and I would think anyone from a company here believes, to understand what's going on with their products. So we would like to see them being able to access the functionality, and given the state of the federal budget, and again, I'm looking at my boss, see how much money she's giving us, the state of the Sentinel budget, we would want to find a way that the companies would, as they are doing now in a more one-off way, support their own, not their own studies. These would be studies that one would hope, again, this national consortium would weigh in on, and they would be of that excellent quality with that kind of transparency. On one level, with the companies having the comfort of knowing that they're using a system and a consortium that the FDA has a lot of faith in.
Great. Thanks. So next question.
Hi, John Rickman, news reporter with FDA News. You mentioned some of the benefits of outsourcing some or all of the development of Sentinel. Could you describe what do you think are some of the biggest challenges FDA has with outsourcing what you call a core function?
We worry about Rich's health and the health of Harvard Pilgrim now. I think there's a mindset change. So there's a culture change within the agency. I think that's very important. I think that the agency, at least I can speak from my own personal experience, I'm much more used to interacting with industry. I think it took Rich and me some time to develop a common vocabulary. I think there's a we're work. It's a very different way of functioning, and so there are, I would say, mostly it's growing pains more than anything else. I think philosophically we think it's the right thing to do, and functionally we think it's doable and sensible. But it's different for us, so I guess I would stick with growing pains.
I wonder if there's just related to this. I mean, I know we talked about it as outsourcing, but it's kind of hard to see how there would be an alternative to doing this as a collaboration with data partners outside of government, and certainly outside of the FDA. I mean, it's in a sense, it's, you know, I guess outsourcing of a core function is new, but also this kind of use of data from a number of different sources that provides a more comprehensive picture of actual medical practice is also new.
I think you're completely right, but I'm sure you remember that 4 years ago, so there were plenty of people at meetings like this saying that the FDA should take all the data into the FDA, into one big computer, if you will, and do it all ourselves. And I think it's only our success at using this other model that has beaten back that that chorus. And you, in the very nice slide that you had during your talks, were those that little box that probably no one noticed of 8 FDA small contracts. Well, that was actually a critical moment. It was Mark's idea, but it was a critical moment where we started looking at the possibilities, because those were open questions. 4 years later, they're not open questions anymore.
Okay, thanks. Next.
Good morning. My name is Richard Eaton. I'm from the Medical Imaging and Technology Alliance. And my question is, well, first I want to thank you for holding these update sessions every year. They are useful. My question is, as you go on and evolve and as the program unfolds, are you planning to solicit input from medical device manufacturers or drug manufacturers in terms of particular components of the plan, elicit comment on whether we have concerns about any components of the plan? So I may be premature because it's early in the session, but I was just curious about that. And what is do you have a timeline for that sort of interaction?
Oh, well, we're currently doing that. Maybe we're not doing it enough. We're certainly probably not doing it as much on the device side as we are the drug biologic side because of some of the issues Dr. Spielberg mentioned. But Brookings hosts regular webinars that are updates and opportunities for questions. Brookings hosts a series of technical meetings, all of which are – the results of which are then posted on the Brookings website. And we have quarterly – they're called basic meetings, which are think tank meetings. And the device industry is always represented at those. If you have specific recommendations for additional outreach that we should be doing, we'd be very eager to hear about that. And Carlos Bell, if you can raise your hand, would be the person to speak to him. If we're not doing as much outreach as we should in the way that we should, we'd like to hear about that, and we will address it.
Thank you.
All right, Carlos Bell, if there are more questions about input and the like, and for those meetings that we host at Brookings, there are email distribution lists, and we can make sure that any of you who want to hear about those and aren't hearing about them as much as you'd like can be on them.
Who's the Brookings person who should get accosted for that one?
We can point to Greg Daniel up here in the front. Right. Go ahead.
When we analyze all the signals in the ERS database using Bildu-Muschel's method, we can see that one ACE inhibitor looks very similar to the other ACE inhibitors, similar with the ARBs, fluoroquinolones, etc. This gets us closer to the biological plausibility, and the technique is being used to identify safer drugs to develop, the ERS data and MGPS. When I am curious, I would love to see the same thing happen from these large data resources. When do you project we will be able to analyze all the data in these large data resources and be able to pinpoint the fingerprint of all adverse events for every drug and understand that we see class effects, etc.? Because this will get us closer to understand sensitivity and specificity.
Yeah, I think that's a good question for the next panel as well, and also I think you're going to be hearing from them about some of the limitations and challenges in getting to these really precise and drug-specific estimates. But go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the same thing. I was going to punt the question to Rich, but also say that some of that will depend on the quality of the data, and we're clearly not there yet. We want to get there, but not yet.
Okay,
Hi, Jill.
Hi, Jill Wexler with Pharmaceutical Executive Magazine. Rachel, at the end of your comments, you mentioned something about PDUFA and changing the efficacy standard and using other evidence to support these things. Could you just explain a little bit more? Is there the idea that Sentinel data could inform unapproved uses or future uses of drugs, and that is there something in the new PDUFA proposal that would support that?
Oh, no, no, no. There's nothing in the PDUFA proposal. It's just a PDUFA year means people start thinking about our statute. You probably know more about this than I do, that a variety of bills have floated in a variety of places. There has always been interest from day one, or at least there's been, I think, a minority of people who believe that you could push a Sentinel button and get an answer about an unapproved drug. I don't think anyone in this room believes that. But what I was trying to say something a little different. I was trying to say that evidence generation is a huge problem facing this country. I believe we'll never really solve it until we, and I think many others do, until we link clinical care with clinical research. But be that as it may, those efforts, I would hope, to look at ways of streamlining evidence development, not decreasing the efficacy standard, but streamlining evidence development. We'll look at Sentinel and see, you know, where we got it right, where we could have done it a little better, and so forth.
I want to attribute this to FDA or anyone at FDA, but it does seem like, you know, with the confluence of the PDUFA reauthorization and a lot of interest right now in ways of further improving the efficiency of getting especially targeted therapies to patients who can benefit, having a more reliable post-market system in place for gathering evidence quickly on both safety and potentially on effectiveness or at least utilization patterns in subgroups could be beneficial. And I know that's going to be an ongoing topic of debate as the as this legislative process moves forward. But I think that, you know, there's a difference between ways of getting better evidence and adjusting the evidence standard, and, you know, it seems to be a lot of consensus that if there are ways to get better evidence faster and especially more confirmatory evidence on drugs where there are, you know, inevitably unanswered questions after approval, Sentinel could potentially be very helpful. Next question.
Good morning. I'm Paul Brown with the National Research Center for Women and Families. Going back to medical devices, what's the major challenge to using Sentinel to monitor medical devices?
No, I don't see anyone from CDRH here, so I'll try. I mean, the lack of a unique device identifier, which Dr. Spielberg mentioned, is probably the biggest obstacle.
And is there the UDI, is that going to be coming out soon? Do we have a timeline on that?
I am the wrong person to ask, but being from the Center for Drugs.
Yeah, I know that CDRH is very, I think, very much agrees with that assessment and is working on it, so hopefully soon. And you're right that with a unique identifier, it would be much easier to plug in devices to an emerging system like this. So I think finding a way to address that has become an even more urgent question. I want to thank Rachel for a great overview and for taking a bunch of comments up here, a bunch of questions. Thank you. Mini Sentinel pilot has made a lot of progress over the past years, you've already heard, and we're going to now talk in a little bit more detail about that progress, as well as the interaction between Mini Sentinel and FDA to interpret and incorporate the results of the pilots that have been undertaken so far into this overall drug safety surveillance system. In thinking about the emerging role of Mini Sentinel in medical product safety, it is important to keep in mind that there are a number of challenging issues to address in its implementation. Part of this stems from the limitations of the data that are in use. Much of the data that's been used so far, as you'll hear from Rich, has been claims data, the medical claims data that were primarily intended for billing. These data are and have been used for many other secondary purposes in recent years. Among those activities are now some of these Mini Sentinel initial projects. These efforts recognize and take advantage of the fact that the data can be a valuable resource for adding to evidence on public health and also a range of other issues related to evidence generated from our healthcare system, but they have their limitations as well. as one of the earlier questions implied, and as Steve mentioned in his comments, I think the general expectation is that additional clinical data are likely to be an increasingly important part of Sentinel going forward, and in some ways are being incorporated in Sentinel studies now. But these data as well, clinical data as well, have their own limitations. And then finally, all of the data generated from actual medical practice that are part of the Sentinel system now, and probably a lot of it going forward as well, are going to be observational in nature. So it's very important to address the potential for confounding of associations between a medical product and some outcomes of interest. Now, understanding how all of these data capabilities and limitations both give Sentinel the opportunities to add importantly to our available evidence, at the same time create a need for caution and methodologic care in how these projects are developed is going to be part of the discussion right now. So we've got two people who are terrific for bringing up these issues and for giving us an update on where they are and what the opportunities and challenges are going to be going forward. That's Richard Platt, who now it is time to see those slides from him. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School and at Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute. And Rich is the principal investigator on the contract with the FDA for the development of the Mini Sentinel Initiative. And we're also very pleased to be joined by Bob Temple, the Deputy Center Director for Clinical Science at the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research at the FDA. So with that, I'll turn this over to Rich.
It's a real pleasure to be able to be back in this room with so many of you who are friends and colleagues and were here a couple of years ago when we were just starting on this set of activities. My official title in the Mini Sentinel program is principal investigator because that was the only box to check. But I'm really the principal cheerleader for a couple of hundred people who are affiliated with one of the 30 organizations that are actively involved as contractors in this activity. So I'm really speaking on behalf of the whole Mini Sentinel investigator group. This is an FDA slide that gave us our marching orders. Develop the scientific operations for active medical product safety surveillance, and create the capability of having continuous access to automated healthcare data systems, so that we could develop a set of methods and also offer the FDA the opportunity to evaluate safety issues, partly to learn the answer and partly to learn how to use these kinds of data. Now, in 2010, when we were in this room, this summarized sort of the state of where we were. We were still a month or two short of being able to even having a statement of work for the Mini Sentinel. And I think all we knew at the time was we were at substantial risk of having the process take control of us. By the time we got to last year, we had a lot to say about systems that we had built, but we didn't have anything to say about anything useful we had really done to make FDA's job easier. And I'm pleased to be able to share with you now at least some information to say that we're able to provide information at times to FDA in a timely enough manner that it's that the information is useful to them. Now, last year, the accomplishments and activities of the Mini Sentinel were well constrained enough that we could give a pretty complete overview of just about everything during this session, and that's really not possible today. So I'm going to be very selective in what I talk about. For more detail, there are a couple of places that I recommend to you. One is later this week, a Mini Sentinel supplement to pharmacoepidemiology and drug safety will go up online. It's It gives, a very good overview and state of the art of the Mini Sentinel, at least as of several months ago. It's 34 peer-reviewed articles, 300 pages. If you have a problem getting to sleep, I think we can help. It covers a substantial array of topics about what we're trying to accomplish, how we're going about it, the way the policies and procedures and data systems work, systematic reviews. This is an open access supplement. We tried very hard to have it available for today, but should be this week. The other place I recommend to you is the Mini Sentinel website. As Rachel said, we are putting just about everything we do up on the website as quickly as we can. The website is updated as information becomes available. This is a screenshot from this morning. The six things shown here as new postings are all new as of yesterday, so evolving content. And here we go into the dive. Post-marketing surveillance in the FDA view of the world has three major components: signal generation. My shorthand for that is data mining. Signal refinement. If you have an idea that there might be if there's reason to look for a specific adverse event related to a specific product. And then signal evaluation, when you have reasonable evidence that there's an association, trying to establish causality. The bulk of our activities are focused on this middle phase, signal refinement. The couple of ways of thinking about that are the repeated assessment of accumulating data, which would be most useful for new products to identify an outcome of prior concern as early as possible, or to do a one-time expedited assessment of a product that's been available for a while but for which a new concern arises. So that's the heart of the activities so far. There are some activities on either side of that, and the boundaries are often not well demarcated, but that's where we're putting the majority of our effort. The five specific goals FDA has asked us to address are to develop a consortium of data partners and investigators, to develop policies and procedures to make the Mini Sentinel work, to create a distributed data network that's capable of actually providing information, to do substantive work on understanding what methods are most appropriate to address the questions that FDA has, and to the extent that there are gaps, to try to fill those gaps, and then actually to do something useful in terms of assessing topics that FDA identifies for us. The major kinds of active surveillance activities that we're engaging in are: first, simply characterizing populations of individuals and their treatments and the health events that they experience. For older products, to assess concerns that arise from any source, to be able to evaluate the impact of FDA regulatory actions on the use of medical products and the health outcomes, and then for new products, to monitor accumulating experience. So let's go through each of those. The consortium of data partners comprises these organizations. Last year, Aetna was a new data partner for the Mini Sentinel, and had really committed only to participating in work on vaccines. I'm happy to say that Aetna is a full data partner now, engaged in the wide array of activities that we're doing, and this year Optum, which is a United Health Group company, has become a Mini Sentinel partner, and we're deep in the mechanics of being able to use the Optum data and to be able to collaborate with the investigators at Optum. The work on policies and procedures has been an ongoing activity. This is a slide from last year. The reason I show it is, first of all, to underscore the first three points, which are extremely important to the Mini Sentinel. First, As Rachel mentioned, this is public health practice, not research. The second is a basic tenet of the mini-sentinel is to minimize the transfer of protected health information and proprietary data through the through this distributed data capability, and the commitment to making all of the work product publicly available. We have put most of our energy in the last year into updating and extending the conflict of interest policies. So last year there was a conflict of interest policy that that dealt with individual investigators, and we are on the cusp of having quite a solid institutional conflict of interest policy to add to that. I think we have done a substantial job in strengthening the conflict of interest work. The distributed data network that we had largely stood up last year focuses on these activities: data capacity and the use of distributed methods. So we have had ongoing work in extending the common data model that underlies our work, in understanding the completeness of the data, in data validity checking, and in understanding how to interpret information that exists as diagnosis and procedure codes. We've been working in both the claims environment, as Mark mentioned, and have made real progress in starting to be able to use electronic health record data, and in facilitating the distribution and retrieval of the distribution of data requests and the retrieval of that information. The common data model that we discussed last year was focused largely on administrative data. We were just starting the work of thinking about how to use vital signs data, height, weight, blood pressure, temperature, and laboratory test results, and have made good progress during this year in making those data available. We're not using it in production mode yet because we're still sort of testing the completeness and the behavior of those data, but they have been fully extracted, and the data checking is well underway. And we're putting a fair amount of time and energy now into linking to registries that exist outside of the data partners, for instance, state immunization registries. The database is updated periodically, and we publish new statistics twice a year. The December 2011 update put us at 126 million individuals, 340 million person years of observation time. For those of us who thought 100 million was a substantial reach, I have to say it's quite something to see that we're able to access a non-trivial fraction of the healthcare information for the U.S. population. That translates into, as McDonald's would say, billions of dispensings and encounters. I want to show you that the electronic health record data applies to a small fraction of these individuals. It's largely from organizations like Kaiser Permanente and the HMO Research Network, which are both health plans and providers, and have electronic health records that are directly linkable to the claims data. So work for us all is to think about how to take advantage of the expanding number of electronic health records that are practice-based and would need to be linked to the population-level data that makes mini-sentinel as useful as it is. This is not a new schematic, but I show it because it's the heart of what makes a distributed system work. That is, the operations center creates, with FDA input, creates requests and submits them through a secure portal. These requests, which we call queries, are computer programs. That is, it's not a plain text request. how many people meet these characteristics and had these outcomes. It's a piece of code that circulates. And the reason that that is so important is that it ensures that that the question is interpreted and applied the same way everywhere. It also greatly reduces the amount of effort that's involved to have multiple data partners respond to queries. So the query goes out to the data partners. The data partners can review it, ensure that it's asking the question that they agreed to answer. They run it without modification. They review they can review the results and then return them to the portal where they're aggregated. So what comes back to the portal in almost every case is counts. And what we do in the operations center is combine those counts, look for consistency across the organizations, and then put them together in a way that's useful for FDA. Whenever possible, we use what we call modular programs. These are really reusable programs for which it's easy to change certain parameter settings. What's the name of the drug? How, if you're looking for new users of these drugs, how much time do you have to be able to look back to assure that this drug was never used? What outcomes are you interested in? What are the age cuts that are important? Things that are fairly easy to specify, but that use the same programs. The reason that we put so much emphasis on this is there are a few ways to get a query right and an uncountable number of ways to get it wrong. And so we've put a great deal of time and energy into trying to decide with FDA what are the questions, what are the kinds of questions that will come up over and over again that are worth making the investment to build very robust programs that we can be sure will run efficiently the first time across all 17 data partners, each of which has a different computing environment and can hang up a program for all kinds of reasons. So these are examples of the kinds of modular programs we're using most now, and I'll show you some examples of the output from these kinds of programs. We've put a lot of time into trying to understand best practice in using administrative data, claims data, which, as Mark pointed out, were designed to facilitate reimbursement, not to support either patient care or the kind of queries we're making. And so during the past year, we completed 20 systematic reviews of the use of administrative data to address specific outcomes of priority interest to FDA. You'll find those systematic reviews posted on our website, and then an even more detailed explication in the Mini Sentinel supplement. We also have always said that because the information in claims data is only a first approximation of truth as it's known to the clinicians, that it's important that the data partners be able to go back to original medical records when it's necessary. Now, there are lots of reasons to minimize doing that, but it's important to do we see that as being an activity that Mini Sentinel will have to do for essentially forever. We completed the first of our activities to validate diagnoses in the Mini Sentinel. We did this partly because we wanted to the answer to the specific question: is it true in the Mini Sentinel that the predictive value of acute myocardial infarction codes is as good as it is said to be in the literature? And partly to test our ability to work in a distributed manner to be able to obtain information from medical records and have an expert adjudication panel look at it. And that worked out pretty well. We were able to obtain 93% of the medical records for acute myocardial infarction that we requested. These were essentially a random sample of of the hundreds of thousands of acute myocardial infarction hospitalizations, and close to 90% of those cases were confirmed by expert panel review. These one more word about how this works. The data partners obtain these records from the hospitals. They redact the identifiable information, so what comes to the adjudicating panel is just the information that's relevant to the to determining the whether the patient had a myocardial infarction or not. The work that's going on now in data development is, first of all, to expand the base population. That's principally our work with Optum now. To incorporate data from immunization registries to develop the capacity to assess blood products. So the immunization registry work and the blood product work is work that the Center for Biologics has asked us to do, and the folks from the Center for Biologics are really sort of very strong partners in developing this. As I mentioned, we're completing the work of doing the data checking for the vital signs and laboratory data. We are undertaking another set of systematic reviews for 18 outcomes that are of particular interest for vaccine safety studies. And we're doing full-text record reviews and adjudications of the predictive values of coded diagnoses for the five topics shown here: acute liver injury, acute renal failure, anaphylaxis, intussusception, and venous thromboembolism. On the horizon, things that we're not doing this year but we know need attention are to be more attentive to the potential of using information in electronic health records and other kinds of registries like state birth registries. And we will put more attention to expanding the library of these reusable modular programs and other kinds of pre-computed data that make it easier to use the large amount of data that we have. Pre-compiled data, better ability to specify exposure and outcomes. We're thinking very hard about how to at least partially automate confounder adjustment. And we're thinking about developing modular programs for so-called self-controlled or case-only designs of studies. So with that as a long throat-clearing exercise, let me share with you. I have to say, before I get to some actual results, we have a very active methodology group. I think some of the finest statistical and epidemiologic methodologists in the country are working with the Mini Sentinel, partly in state-of-the-art assessments of what's available now and how can it be applied to the kinds of questions that FDA has, partly to do a gaps analysis, and then with FDA to prioritize work on developing new methods. This year, the largest piece of that work has been in assessing study design, the choice of study designs and automated confounding adjustment, and in thinking very hard about this issue of sequential analysis. That is, if we're going to be monitoring data as it accumulates, that means a set of kinds of analyses which are not conceptually new but raise a number of important issues when applied to the kinds of data that we're talking about now. We're also putting some effort into data mining, particularly around vaccine safety. We don't have time, and frankly, I don't have the expertise to do justice to this kind of work. So, let me refer you to the supplement in particular, which has a number of very thoughtful, extremely useful articles on these topics that I think are useful. They're certainly useful to the Mini Sentinel, but I think have utility beyond the Mini Sentinel. But I will say that the things that are either going on now or that are the major future directions we're thinking about are adapting inverse probability weighting, which sometimes goes under the name of marginal structural models, to sequential monitoring, being able to adapt work on automated confounding control to both propensity scores and disease risk scores to develop a simulation framework that will let us test a lot of the things that are important. We're thinking about how to do anonymous linkage between data sources. We have tens of millions of people's worth of data that's administrative data held by 17 data partners, and then there's electronic health record data that lives in entirely different environments, and putting those together in a way that is maximally protective of personal identities is an important topic, and we think that anonymous linkage may make a difference here. And finally, we're thinking hard about how you could analyze data in a distributed environment without building a single analytical data set, even for individual questions. Now let me spend some time sort of sharing with you some of the things that we've been doing with FDA. The kinds of applications that we're talking about are characterizing exposures and outcomes, monitoring accumulating experience, and looking at the impact of regulatory action. So in the characterize exposures and health events, we have performed well over 100 queries for FDA, just characterizing the treatment and treatment patterns of the covered population, age, sex, calendar year, distributions of numbers of users and new users of drugs in these classes. I won't read them all, but it's quite a wide array of some of the most commonly used medical products. We've also done queries for the Center for Biologics around vaccines and for the Center for Devices. And these are typically very rapid turnaround queries that are intended to be low impact that can help inform FDA's decisions about whether to come use mini-sentinel for a deeper dive or to inform other kinds of decision-making. Results of these kinds of queries typically come back within a few days and are a relatively light hit on the data partners. Similarly, looking at the occurrence of health events, we've had requests in many of the major organ systems. These are some of the examples of the kinds of things that FDA has asked us to look at. Here's an example of purely descriptive information about who's treated with what agents. Prasugrel, a platelet antagonist, is indicated for prevention of thrombotic cardiovascular events in selected patients. It's contraindicated with a history of transient ischemic attack or stroke. So the question is, among patients who are newly treated with this agent, what's their prior history? So we aren't asking what happens to them. We're asking who's the cohort of patients who are initiated. And at FDA's request, we looked at that and compared those individuals with individuals who receive clopidogrel, another platelet antagonist that does not have this contraindication. So here's the kind of data that comes back. It's not days, but it's a week or two or three with this agent. What's their prior history? So we aren't asking what happens to them. We're asking who's the cohort of patients who are initiated. And at FDA's request, we looked at that and compared those individuals with individuals who receive clopidogrel, another platelet antagonist that does not have this contraindication. So here's the kind of data that comes back. It's not days, but it's a week or two or three. There were 153,000 new users of clopidogrel, about 7,000 new users of prasugrel. And here are the number of people who had during the year before the initiation of their therapy had the condition of interest. So that's about 17% of clopidogrel users had a diagnosis of stroke during the year before, and something under half that fraction for prasugrel, and here's the figures for TIA. So what's the bottom line? Some prasugrel users had a prior diagnosis of TIA or stroke. It's substantially fewer than it was for clopidogrel users. Lots of limitations to this kind of quick look at the question. A couple of them here are that these codes have not been verified in the mini-sentinel data set, and we only look back a year. It's possible that these conditions could have occurred more than a year before. But to be able to ask the question and get an answer in a fairly short period of time is something that just wasn't possible before we had these data resources. The second category of activities is for older products to rapidly assess concerns arising really from any source, for instance, from the adverse event reporting system. And FDA has asked us to look at a number of exposure outcome pairs: angiotensin receptor blockers and celiac disease, drugs for smoking cessation and cardiac outcomes, drugs for Parkinson's disease and acute myocardial infarction or stroke, analeptics and severe cutaneous adverse reactions, oral hypoglycemics and hypersensitivity reactions, atypical antipsychotics and hypersensitivity reactions, vascular endothelial growth factor inhibitors, osteonecrosis of the jaw, direct thrombin inhibitors and warfarin and hemorrhage as the outcome, and aspirin antagonists and stroke or transient ischemic attack. You'll recognize that that's the follow-on question to the one that I just described. Let me show you one example. The first one I listed, angiotensin II receptor blockers and celiac disease. Our FDA colleagues told us that there was a signal in the ARES database that one of the angiotensin receptor blockers appeared to have more cases than FDA expected of celiac disease that was attributed to the agent. The review of the cases was inconclusive, and there was no apparent trivial explanation for this apparent clustering of cases for this angiotensin receptor blocker. And so we looked at FDA's request. We used the modular programs to identify the new users of all the angiotensin receptor blockers and then identify among those the ones who had a first diagnosis of celiac disease while they were still receiving these agents. So here's the results for the five angiotensin receptor blockers for which there were at least 10,000 new users. A new user is defined as someone who has been under observation for at least a year without having had an angiotensin receptor blocker and then has a first dispensing. So the fact that we are using data sets for which we know eligible person time and can say with relative confidence that the person hadn't received, that this was really the first time in a year, is quite important because these people had prescription drug coverage. We are reasonably confident that if they had been dispensed the drug, that we would know it. So you can see that these are pretty much of a piece. On the ordinate is the new cases of celiac disease defined as first diagnosis code. And they are pretty tightly clustered. The specific receptor blocker that triggered this was olmesartan, which is right in the middle. So where does that take us? FDA will use this as Melissa, what's the term? One tool in the toolbox, as a piece of information to help it decide whether and how much more deeply to dive on this topic. We are always mindful of the limitations of this kind of analysis because it's not a full epidemiologic study. It's intended to be an answer that comes back pretty quickly that guides a next step. So among the limitations here are we may not have found the fact that we looked at the diagnoses doesn't mean we have found all of the people who have the condition. It may be that the diagnosis of celiac disease includes the people that we really care about and other people. There may be differences in underlying risk between the people exposed to one of the angiotensin receptor blockers and another. not shown on this slide, it's remarkable how short the exposures are on average to these drugs. But the average exposure, although there are lots of person years of exposure, the average exposure is a few months. And the fact that we don't see a substantial excess doesn't exclude the fact that there might be. We also didn't look at subsets who might be at special risk. So there's lots of reasons not to say that this is a definitive result, but it's a useful result within a few weeks' time. If you want to take a look at the report of this, it's posted on the Mini Sentinel website. This is a screenshot from that report that it goes on at substantial length. And as you can see, just in the screenshot, we looked at all seven of the drugs. I showed you the five for which there was, I thought, enough use to be interesting for today. In addition to using these modular programs, these reusable programs, there are a lot of important questions that FDA has that are they're either not amenable to reusable programs or we haven't built the reusable programs yet. And so these are examples of the kinds of one-time assessments that require the development of a protocol. And that's a time-consuming activity. It's not just the writing the code, it's the thinking about what it is that you really want to do and how to make use of the data that are available. So I've listed here six of those activities that are ongoing now. Four of them are vaccine safety studies, rotavirus vaccine and intussusception, influenza vaccines and febrile seizures, pregnancy outcomes, human papilloma virus and venous thromboembolism, and then two drug outcomes, these antihypertensives and angioedema, and aripiprazole and venous thromboembolism. These are in various states of work. Typically, these are undertaken by a specially constituted work group, a group of mini sentinel investigators who have content expertise and FDA staff who have content expertise who work together for a period of as long as it takes to develop a protocol and then to implement it. Let me show you just some examples of where those are. This is the rotavirus vaccine and intussusception study. The protocol was finalized. The study is underway. There's close to 2 million children who have, close to 2 million doses, 465,000 children. And at the first cut, there are 64 cases that meet the claims diagnosis codes for rotavirus, for intussusception. This is a study that will validate each of those diagnoses by requesting the charts and doing a expert adjudication. This is the HPV4 vaccine and venous thromboembolism study. Close to 1 million adolescents immunized, 2.4 million doses, 119 ICD-9 qualified cases within 28 days after vaccination. Those records too are being retrieved and adjudicated. Influenza vaccine and febrile seizures, 860,000 people who had a first dose of influenza vaccine, and 91 people with a febrile seizure code within a day of the vaccine dose. So substantial amount of time and energy going into those studies. Work on monitoring the impact of FDA actions. The FDA has selected its labeling change for long-acting beta agonists as the sort of first in class for that study. There's a work group that's active now. It's a work group that is FDA personnel and many Sentinel investigators developing the protocol for that. And then last but certainly not least is the prospective evaluation of new products. At last year's meeting, we talked about the fact that we were going to look at anti-diabetic drugs in acute myocardial infarction. And and actually had had a first protocol up on the website. Lots has happened since then. The basic premise is still the same: repeated evaluation of acute myocardial infarction risk in new users of saxagliptin versus four comparator agents. The protocol's been rewritten in a substantial way to deal with our better understanding of how to address this. So if you look on the website, there is a new protocol there, but there's going to be substantial case mix adjustment via disease risk scores and propensity scores. And here's where we are now. Over 250,000 new users of these agents have been identified, 6,000 saxagliptin users. These data only ran through December of 2010, so the next update, we imagine, will have a substantial increase in this because saxagliptin's a new drug, but you can see where the others are now. The challenges are still the same challenges we had in 2010. This is a 2010 slide. Lots of things that make this, on the one hand, both harder and, on the other hand, very interesting to do. And we keep these in mind all the time, in particular the fact that timeliness is extremely important. And so a lot of what we're doing is saying not what's perfect, but what can we do quickly that will make a difference to FDA. And we're very mindful of the need to avoid false alarms. We're studying a lot of different things in a lot of different ways, and the laws of chance say that some of the things that look as though they are serious problems aren't, and so we're trying to build in as many protections as we can on that. I want to echo Mark's and Rachel's and Steven Spielberg's comments that we really believe that what we're doing is useful not only for FDA, but it's creating both a resource in terms of a distributed data system and a method of querying it, and a lot of lessons learned about how to make effective secondary use of routinely collected electronic health data. And so we certainly hope that will be of use to the to the healthcare system and to the nation as a whole. I want to close by saying the work we've been able, the things we've been able to accomplish, are really the product of a very large number of people at FDA and Brookings and in the Mini Sentinel Investigator Group. This has been this is the kind of project that can fail almost every day, and there have been remarkably few crises, and that I think is a real tribute to the leadership of FDA, especially I have to call out Rachel and Janet Woodcock, who have been extremely sort of prescient in setting this up in a way that it avoids some of the things that could cause sort of fatal problems. And I think Brookings has helped enormously. So we have had the sense that we've been working, sort of had a tailwind in this work that we've done. And I can't begin to name all of the many Sentinel investigators who have participated, but I can just let them scroll by as Bob Temple comes up. So thanks very much for letting me share this update with you.
That's great, Rich. Thanks for that very thorough report while the credits are still rolling. Next up, I see we're on Vanderbilt, so that must be about the end. Next up is Bob Temple, the Deputy Director for Clinical Science at Cedar. And Bob, I don't know if you want to, do you want to come on up here? Right.
Thanks. It's very interesting to be here. I'm not as embedded in Sentinel as the other people you've heard, but there's one particular potential use that I want to talk about that excites me particularly, not to disparage any of the other things that you've heard about, which are also exciting. So, obviously, when you have a new expensive tool, the big question is, what will we really be able to do with it? What will we get that we didn't have? And Rich has described a whole lot of possibilities, and some of them seem particularly exciting to me. Eventually, I'm impressed by the over 120 million. You're getting close to the population that contributes to AIRS, which is everybody. This is something like a third of it, which means that potentially, at least, you won't just get the you won't have only the cases that someone decides in his wisdom to submit to AIRS, but you'll actually have rates of whatever these events are in a wide range of populations. So it gives you an almost controlled database for very, very, very rare events, which is sort of what everybody's dream of active surveillance is. The trouble with active surveillance is usually there's no control group, but here there are many potential control groups. Very, very exciting. Even for, especially in some ways, for very rare events, as I'll show later, we've always felt we could identify drugs that were hepatotoxic because the rate of injury in the people who got the drug was, we thought, way, way larger than would be the background rate. So you sort of look at the data and you think you know that. In fact, it hasn't always been that easy for drugs that may cause less frequent liver injury. We agonized for years about nifazodone and some of the other antidepressants, where we thought maybe the rate was 1 in 50,000 or 1 in 100,000. It's not so easy to know how that differs from background. But with this size database, you conceivably can look at that, which is a major sort of advance. The second obvious thing is that there are many sites that give you data, and the data are different, and the people in them are different. So if you believe, as I do, and I actually wrote this a long time ago, that no epidemiologic study should be published until it's at least replicated once, we have a huge opportunity to look at multiple databases, really unmatched, and to do it fairly fast. As Rich said, the use of the system to figure out what people are doing with their drugs, what they're using them with, whether they're avoiding contraindications and all that kind of stuff, that's a sort of obvious and low-hanging fruit use because you don't need a control group for that particularly. It's descriptive. And one can imagine that this system could be used by asking drug companies to see if they can look within it to see if there are contraindications or new maneuvers to prevent bad use or being observed. It seems very potentially useful for that. I know some epidemiologists think you can evaluate effectiveness with these kinds of systems, but if you think like I do, and like most epidemiologists when they're writing for publication do, you don't give much credibility to relative risks less than 2, maybe 1.5 if you're an optimist, and very few drugs have an effectiveness in that neighborhood. Not none, but hardly any. So I'm not expecting much there, but, you know, we'll see. The thing that I wanted to focus on, though, and I think it's very exciting once you know how we find out about what drugs do, is the thing that we have trouble with in AIRS is dealing with potentially large increases in risks that are not all that rare. An obvious one is, you know, does the drug cause heart attacks or something like that? But those are hard because even drugs that behave very badly don't increase it by more than a little. But there are others that have plagued us over the years. For example, do drugs that are intended for, I don't know, weight loss, smoking, or something like that cause depression, violence, suicide attempts? Well, those kinds of events are not all that rare. They occur in the population that isn't treated with anything. So when we get reports of these events, it's not easy to know what to do. Just to take one example, for two decades, we were getting reports that people given antidepressants would go off the deep end and become violent or become suicidal. Well, they were depressed. How do you know whether the drug did it or the patient's underlying disease did it? And if you believe the reports, the concerns, the argument was that there was a really large increase in this, not a 20% increase or something like that, but a really large increase. Well, those were very hard to assess, and we actually didn't put those things in the labeling initially, but more recently with some of the smoking cessation and things like that, we have included those kinds of data. I think that this system gives us an opportunity to check some of things, those things out in a way that we've never had before, and that is extremely exciting. So it's worth remembering that epidemiologic data can detect large increases in risk. We learned about thromboembolic disease with OCs from epi studies, endometrial cancer with unopposed estrogens, valvulopathy with fenfluramine, because the risks were large, four, five, maybe more fold. And these systems are very good for that. So how have, in fact, we found large risks of drugs? And I'm going to look most closely at the risks that were large enough to make us take a drug off the market. You could also look at box warnings and things like that. In fact, if you go through the list, and I'll show you my list, we have taken drugs off the market mostly because they caused very uncommon, things that were uncommon in the general population, serious and fatal events, and as I said, these were extraordinarily rare without the presence of a drug, probably reflecting relative risks of more than 10, maybe more than 100, especially when you look not at the annual rate of these events, but at how often they occur in a week or 2 weeks, which is when they occur if you take a drug. So as I'll show you, a lot of drugs have been taken off because they caused major hepatic injury. We think that our ability to predict that is now better, so we don't expect to see that so much anymore. We've taken drugs because they caused torsade de pointe type arrhythmia, and we think we know how to anticipate those, so we don't expect to see those anymore. Drugs have been taken off because they caused Stevens-Johnson syndrome, acute renal failure, hematologic abnormalities, things like that. And as I said, you could look at things that led to box warning. So how do we detect those? Oh, this is my list. I don't expect you to be able to read it. But if you look at the column that says data 1, 2, 3, 1 means that we found them basically in AERS, sometimes with some help from publications. And almost all the drugs that went away, till recently, went away because we discovered bad news in AERS. Sometimes this was supported by knowledge of their pharmacology, that they prolonged the QT interval, so that was joined with it. But it's amazing that the individual case reports, or numerous individual case reports, have been the basis for withdrawal of most of the drugs that have left the market, and plenty of box warnings too. But that was possible because torsade is really rare if you don't have a drug that prolongs your QT interval, because acute liver injury is very rare if you don't have a drug that causes it. But there's lots of other things where it's not so easy to know the background rate. And we've had, as I said, interest in suicidality or violent behavior, which, as we know from reading the papers, is not as rare as we'd like it to be. We've had drugs that may or may not have caused pancreatitis, which is not all that rare, especially in the diabetics who were the recipients of these drugs. So how do you decide whether the drug did it or whether it just is part of the background rate in this population? And, in fact, it's very hard. So what do? We do our best. You look at the case and you see if there's some other explanation, see if they've had it before, things like that. And then you try to make some guess as to what the background rate of the condition is but it's very hard to do. So what do? We look to see if it's a good case, exclude other causes, look at the timing, look at rechallenge, non-rechallenge, and dechallenge. We now, more recently, have used data mining to help decide whether the rate seems higher than expected. Data mining is a little bit crude. This is an attempt to see to compare the observed rate with this drug with the expected rate, and the expected rate is based on basically the rate in all other patients. So you look at all the drugs and their reporting rate for pancreatitis, and you try to see whether that rate is elevated. That's not bad, but all kinds of things can affect the rate of reporting, the underlying disease, and it's difficult to do. It would be nicer if you had a system that had all the patients, had all the drugs they had, had a wide variety of possible control groups to look at, and so that would be better. Anyway, we worry if it seems likely that the risk is greater than background, but that is not easy to know. Sentinel gives us one more thing to do, and it's extremely exciting. So it ought to be able to rapidly assess potential causality here. I know nobody likes to use causality when you're talking about epidata, but we do anyway, really, because we put it in the label and stuff. So if the cases are good and well described and the system is good at detecting these, and people like Rich will have to decide whether that's true, and if the rate seems really higher than expected, that is, it survives your data mining analysis. This is the signal we're talking about in AERS. So the cases are good. The rate seems higher than expected. But there is uncertainty about reporting artifacts. The drug is new. Maybe everybody's reporting more rapidly. Maybe there's been a lot of publicity about it. Maybe the comparator agents have been around for a long time, and you don't really know what the background rate is. That's a case where Sentinel might really do the job. And we have a recent example. As everybody knows from our reports, when we, in some recent AERS analyses, we got a huge number of cases of bleeding with dabigatran, an anticoagulant that is known to cause bleeding. We all know that. But the rate of reporting was way, way, way higher than it was for Coumadin, which, of course, had much greater use. So that didn't entirely make any sense. So what we had was hundreds of reports of serious bleeding, maybe 350 is the number that I dimly remember, far more than we received for Coumadin. But we also had an 18,000-patient study in atrial fibrillation called RELY, which was the basis for approval of dabigatran. And in that, both Coumadin and dabigatran had serious bleeding rates of about 5%. So why did we have so many reports? If we'd gotten all the reports of what must have been major bleeding on Coumadin, surely we'd have many thousands, but we didn't. So why would we see that? What's going on? And while our belief that this was real was low, you don't want to be too smug about these things. Maybe something about people in trials versus people in the real world is different, and we're not smart enough to know what it is. It's something you would like to know more about. Now, we're still working on this. We don't have data that's usable on this because the drug's too new, and we don't have the case reports and stuff like that. But it's a place where Sentinel represents an opportunity to look at something that would be troublesome if it were true and isn't necessarily particularly plausible, but you really don't want to just let it rest. You really want to look, and we will. So we'll be able to see that. The celiac disease example that Rich described is another one. If the report was true, the excess was very large. Whether that was especially plausible or not, I don't know, but it now appears that the drug that was singled out didn't look any different from anything else. That's pretty reassuring. There must have been some data on, like, people with ACE inhibitors too, right? All of the drugs were the same class. Maybe it's a class effect.
I'll have to go. We can all look online.
We got to see with diuretics.
As I recall from this morning, the thiazides were included, and I just don't
that'd
remember
be good.
That.
Anyway, these are opportunities. I mean, the characteristic of these is that if it's a true bill, if it's really true, the increase in risk is quite substantial, the sort of thing that even skeptics like me believe epidemiologic studies can detect. We can discuss that more some other time. I have many favorite examples of these. Other things that we could look at the same way. I remember I mentioned we've seen individual reports of psychiatric problems with drugs, very disturbing. People come to advisory committees and describe how life-destroying they were, and they are. They're terrible. You'd really want to know if it was true. But if it's not true, you really don't want to label a drug as doing that because it might interfere with something that's very useful. So another distinct possibility surely would be to look for psychiatric problems when these are reported. You could look for rates of PML with drugs for multiple sclerosis and see whether those rates are high because, again, compared to background rates, which are essentially zero, the hazard ratios are very large. So you could look at all of those things. I just want to flag one other, and Rich hinted at this, a potential benefit. When the background rate of serious events, what the background rate of even serious events is can be very hard to know. Even for something obvious and drug-related like severe hepatic injury, when the rate associated with drug use is really quite low, and we thought for the antidepressants it was certainly less than 1 in 50,000, it can be very hard to decide whether this is above background or not. And we agonized for years about whether nifazodone was a little hepatotoxic, not hepatotoxic, and so on. But if and when sentinel becomes large enough, it really should be able to detect the most rare events you can even imagine because it will have good data on background rates from the fact that it is covering 120 million people. That's a good way to get background rates. And for some of these lower rates of serious events, it really may be the active surveillance we've always dreamed about, which is extremely exciting. And that's the end.
All right, I'd like to thank both of you for covering a tremendous amount of ground on a very important and challenging set of topics related to sentinel implementation. So now is another one of those times for comments, questions, and once again, we have microphones at two spots in the room. And what I'd like to ask you all to do you stay up here, and I'll go. And would like to ask those of you in the audience to come up to the microphones and again identify who you are when you ask your question. Please go ahead.
I guess it's Office of Pharmacovigilance and Epidemiology. That's quite a mouthful. Just before the meeting, Rich Platt asked me if we were doing anything with some of these very large databases, and I said yes. I've been working with Glenn Zornberg on looking for really bad liver problems, such as Bob described. Acute liver failure, death, or transplant. Now, that's serious. That's bad stuff. That's grade 4 or 5 in the NIH severity scale. And looking at very large numbers, we found a few, 10 or 12 cases. Now, when we then looked at what was available from these very large millions and millions databases, we couldn't figure out what was going on. We saw that tests had been ordered and paid for. Procedures had been done and paid for, but no results, no reason why the tests were ordered or what was concluded, no medical information. So this is the nub of the problem. What we're looking at is not telling us what we want to know. We need more information. The problem is, what was the cause? Was it the drug or was it disease? Was it background rate or was it induced? Now, in order to find out, we need medical information. All of you who've been trained as internists know what it is to write a discharge summary or a death summary. You review that. I've done thousands of them, so have you all. This is a valuable source. Can we get to that information without violating consumer, patient, people's rights and privileges and confidentiality and so forth? That information is essential if we're going to go beyond just detecting cases.
Great question, Rich. Do you want to comment on the challenges there?
I agree completely with your with the way you frame this, and it's part of the sort of the constitution of the Mini Sentinel that all of the data partners have access to the full text medical records in the cases where it's necessary. And so that example I gave of the validation of acute myocardial infarctions is an example of that. It was possible to get 93% of the records, the full text records for the selected cases. And there's a work group now that's tackling acute liver injury. So we should just make sure that that this work group is sufficiently integrated into the work that you and Gwen are doing on that specific topic.
Rich, can I ask you, Paul Watkins, in an earlier comment, wondered about what I take to be the ability to go back to the people who had the liver injury and get some genetic information, which is a very exciting possibility. We've discovered at least one drug that is only injurious to people with a genetic predictor, lemarikoxib. So that's very exciting. Is there any possibility of that?
Well, the data partners know who these individuals are. I mean, they're the payers, or in some cases the providers. So the answer is, in principle, that's entirely possible. And one of the good things about your DNA is it doesn't change that much over time. So it doesn't matter whether you ask for it after the event or before. But we'll have to think very carefully about setting up the right kinds of patient protections and communications. Come the day when it's important to do that work, it will need a lot of input from a very broad stakeholder group about how to set that up to do it in a way that both serves the public interest and protects the legitimate privacy concerns and the sensibilities of us. I mean, if given these numbers, a fair number of us in the room have our data in the systems that we're looking at. I know I do. And so sort of think about how you'd want to get the request, probably not from some guy you've never heard of like me, saying, you know, would you be willing to give us a buccal swab? So the issues, I think, are largely sort of procedural, sort of whether we have the raw capability to do that.
Jill?
The comments, Bob, that you made about better understanding some of the relationships between drug use and large adverse events are very interesting. And I'm wondering if Sentinel and the kind of system that you're envisioning and setting up now was available, say, 5 or 10 years ago, if it could have better addressed some of the large safety issues that emerge, such as Vioxx and some of these other sort of crises in understanding these things.
Well, we're talking about thresholds here. What I think it can be dramatically good for is reports that might represent a very large increase in risk. There have been some drugs to which pancreatitis has been attributed. I think the thought there is that the risk ratio is probably fivefold or something like that, and these systems can detect that. Whether epidemiologic studies can detect Vioxx and things like that is debatable. There have been major epidemiologic studies looking at non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and their results, and they sort of suggest a little increase for Vioxx at the 1.8 level. But I'm always struck by the fact that a study done by very good people, including Wayne Ray and our own David Graham, that looked at adverse event rates for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs showed that the very best drug was, you guess, What's the best drug? Lowest rate of cardiac events, Celebrex. Now, does anybody believe that? Are we ready to stop the precision trial because we already know the answer? I don't think so. So at those rates, I distrust those findings. Obviously, not all epidemiologists do. But when you get them in a room and they're saying what risk, you know, Jerry Kornfield used to say threefold, I believe. Sid Shapiro has said anything less than two, throw it away. And obviously, there's a debate about this and how, you know, I'm not going to try to settle it. But I think everybody would agree that if you see a 3-, 4-, 5-fold rate, which might be the risk of pancreatitis, say, you're looking for, or mental disturbance you're looking for with one of these drugs, I think it can detect those. And I don't think we put those things into the label unless we think the hazard is considerably increased, probably at that level, because we all know small risks in an air system can't be reliably detected. But if you're worried enough that there's a really large increase, I think the system can detect it. And that's why I gave the example of dabigatran. I mean, if it has a 20% increase in bleeding compared to Coumadin, we're not going to detect that. We probably don't even care. But the reports came in the many hundreds, 350 in no time, as if the risk is 10 times as great. Well, if that's true, you'll find it. And that's very exciting.
Rich, you want to add anything to this?
Nope. It's nice to hear Bob's thoughts on this.
And just we're talking about like potential future extensions of the Sentinel approach. Any comments on the potential for some version of randomization in actual practice?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that out. When we talk about the additional uses for these kinds of data, I think there's a very appealing complementarity between clinical trials and the mini Sentinel distributed data set. A great deal. I think there are a number of places like that, but whenever the outcome is something that you would expect as a matter of course to be captured by in routine care, it should be possible to offload that that requirement from a clinical trials setting. So if an outcome is hospitalization for myocardial infarction or serious hypoglycemic events or whole range of things, you can imagine a much simpler clinical trials environment in which the work of the clinical trial is to initiate therapy. If it's a clinical trial of drugs that let's say it's of drugs that are approved and marketed, you could use the mini Sentinel infrastructure to monitor adherence to therapy and to monitor many of the important outcomes. And so you can imagine these would fall into the category of pragmatic trials, but they would be much more efficient. It would be possible to do much larger trials. I think taking one more step, I've been very attracted to the idea of cluster randomization in which whole practices or delivery systems might be randomized to one or another therapy, and it would be possible to have that kind of system operate almost transparently using these kinds of data. So I think there are lots of opportunities in the clinical trial environment. I agree with Bob that it is much harder to address effectiveness than in observational data than it is safety. I think there are some situations where we might decide that these data are good enough to address certain kinds of effectiveness questions. And so I think we'd have to be thoughtful, just in the way we have to be thoughtful about whether you can address a safety problem with these kinds of data. I think it's worth being thoughtful about the situations in which we could do effectiveness work. I think it should be possible to do a lot of work on quality of care and look at variations in care. Using these kinds of data, and I think back to the question about what about supporting robust genetic analyses. I think there's a whole array of what we now think of as standard biomedical research that could take advantage of the kinds of capabilities that we're developing here. It's not public health practice. The data partners haven't signed on to these things. FDA, I know, has its plate full and so isn't looking to be the owner of these things. But among the things that the FDA determined in its wisdom is that the data resources that have been created belong to the data partners, who are free to use it as they see fit for their own purposes. So it would be pretty easy, compared to the work that's gone into creating the mini-Sentinel data structures, it would be pretty straightforward to set up separate systems that look a lot like this, that look at the same data resources, if the data partners choose to participate in them. One of the data partners have always been the key on this, and it's been their willingness to be thoughtful investigators who are engaged in these activities. And I think there's every reason to think it would be possible to set up these similar kinds of activities that use the same resources.
Thanks, Rich. We have time for a couple more questions.
Yeah, I just have two quick questions. I'm Lisa Lavange from the Office of Biostatistics at CEDAR. You talked about data quality, and you mentioned the results of pulling the cases for the acute MI hospitalizations. And I was, I think we would all agree the data quality is important because there are lots of exciting results that come out of the mini-Sentinel database. Do you have the ability to look at the variability of the quality by your different partners? And I recognize that some of the partners are a lot bigger than other partners. And also, are you having plans to look at the non-MI cases so you can confirm the cases that were correctly MI, but there might be some hospitalizations that should have been MI that are not showing up, and that's a little harder to sample? And then I think it will be important to look at the quality of the exposure reporting. That's a little trickier too, but with some things like vaccines, you can check procedural codes. I was involved in monitoring one of the rotavirus vaccines when it was newly approved, and we asked one of your partners to check the procedural codes to make sure the right vaccine was being reported on the claims data. You want to get the exposure right just like you want to get the cases right. So just suggestions, or maybe you've already thought of this and that's in the plans.
Yeah.
That's my quality question, and if I can throw one other out and then you can answer both. I'm interested in how the methodology work interfaces with the data center. The data center is very exciting with the common data model and the query operations that you've got going on. When the groups, I know of one group looking at the signal detection methods, I think they would love to have access to some of the central data to evaluate the performance of some new methods with old methods or competing methods. And I don't know if the method side of Sentinel is talking to the data operation side of Sentinel, but I was just curious about that. Thanks.
Okay. I'm not sure how quickly you can answer those questions, but I want to encourage you to
okay.
do so.
And like a certain Texas governor, I have trouble remembering more than two things. We always look across the 17 data partners, and that's a hugely instructive activity. That's not algorithm driven so much as eyeballing the results, and it's a very effective way to find important outliers. Sometimes we bring to the attention of the data partners things about their data that they were just unaware of because they had no reason to think that they were an outlier in some regard. Looking at the cases that were not diagnosed as acute myocardial infarction is really tough. The predictive value of not having a diagnosis of acute myocardial infarction is very high just at random, so we'd have to sample a very large number of charts. The thing that we could do is say if we're missing a diagnosis of acute myocardial infarction, how would it be most likely to be miscoded and review some of those? And we know to do that. We weren't prepared to do it in that particular case, but when there's a specific outcome that's of interest, we're prepared to do that. Are we prepared to look at the accuracy of the exposure reporting? Maybe we could talk about that during the break. But we're here. Most of the exposures we're looking at are the dispensing of a product to an individual. And the state of the art is typically that if a person renews a prescription for an agent, that
that's prima facie evidence that it's being consumed, or in a procedure code if a vaccine is administered, that we take that as being accurate. It's typically very hard to do better than that by reviewing the records. And with regard to the data, connecting the methodologist to the data systems, there's a two-part answer. One is we have an internal sort of test data set that's usable for mini-Sentinel licensed, mini-Sentinel partners. It's the Florida Medicaid data set that the methodologists use. But here's a shout-out to OMOP. Is it okay, Tom, to say? Mm-hmm. Our plan is for OMOP to create a mini-Sentinel version of one of the OMOP core data sets that would be relatively widely available to anyone who wants to either try out the code that we post or write code that would work against the mini-Sentinel. We would, speaking for the mini-Sentinel, we would love to be able to start establishing partnerships with an array of stakeholders who have expertise and bandwidth to create new methods that we would be able to take advantage of. And I hope that the OMOPs creating that kind of resource will facilitate that.
Thanks. We have two questions. We're a little bit over time, but I'm trying to get these in if we can do them real quickly. Go ahead, Bob.
Things like miscoding, I assume, make noise that drive any finding toward zero or toward one, right? So
it depends, but often that's the case. Yeah.
Okay, so you mostly worry about whether it obscured something, not whether it gave you a false finding?
Well, we're worried.
One very quick question. Timeliness and accuracy are both very critical to any active surveillance system. Your methodology, mini-Sentinel, is very much great for accuracy. Are you indeed considering and, in fact, doing a methodology to assess your timeliness insofar as the surveillance from Sentinel itself?
Yes. Because so much of our data comes from claims data systems and it takes a while for those systems to mature, we have erred on the side of waiting longer rather than going faster. And so the reason that the saxagliptin, sitagliptin data is end of 2010 is that was the most recent data that was in the most recent update, which was the July update. We are working particularly at the request of the Center for Biologics to ask whether and under what circumstances we can move that along faster. And because if you're interested in getting any information at all about this year's influenza vaccine safety profile, you can't use this system. I see my friend Arnold Chan nodding because we did work several years ago asking how fast can you make it work. And our thought is, in order to go faster, you need to pick the specific exposures. It's not possible, at least under the scenario that we have now, for all the data partners to update everything, let's say every month instead of every quarter. On the other hand, it is possible to extract all of the influenza immunizations every month, if that's necessary. And we actually did that in looking at the H1N1 vaccine safety. That's the so-called PRISM study that was really the foundation for much of the work in biologics. And a number of our data partners who are in the room were participants. I would say we're survivors of that activity. So we're trying to figure out what would be a sustainable activity. It will almost certainly focus on specific products rather than everything.
Ralph Horowitz from GSK. Actually, this is a question for Dr. Temple, and it follows up the very provocative and interesting suggestion that we might use Sentinel data in the future to help make more efficient randomized trials of treatment efficacy by collecting data from those type of systems. For myocardial infarction, as was suggested as an example, that would mean we might want to tolerate a 15% misclassification rate, at least as it's currently estimated, from those data. For congestive heart failure, maybe the misclassification rate would be higher. For some other outcomes, higher still. So in a setting where we have traditionally placed a very high emphasis on the accuracy of data, I wonder if you'd comment on how you view the utility of these data for application in those kinds of settings.
Well, some errors matter more than others. You want to be, if you're trying to see whether one drug or another has adverse effects on people in terms of causing heart attacks or causing death, you really would like to miss as few deaths and heart attacks as possible. If what you're trying to do is evaluate the baseline history of people, knowing whether they had a heart attack in the past or something like that, that is probably less critical than the outcome measures. And so you really have to think about each of the events and see how good you are. We probably think mortality data is pretty good. I mean, you know, that's not a hard judgment call. Whether someone had a heart attack is probably not too bad either. They've gone to the hospital for it. Somebody decided whether they did or not. Where you have to be suspicious is what their past history is. That may or may not have been recorded, and there's going to be an error rate in that. But that's not really nearly as critical, actually, and that's something we face in controlled trials all the time. I just wanted to add one other thing. The possibility that these systems can be used to stimulate, encourage, find people for controlled trials is extraordinarily exciting, but it requires a mental change by the country. People have to believe that the best thing that can happen to them is to be randomized into a trial. Now, the pediatric cancer community all believes that because there's not such good treatment, but if the public really wanted to know whether we can learn about whether things work in this setting or whether things work in that setting and make a more intelligent and rational system, maybe they'll all sign up and join it. But there's got to be a lot of advocacy for that because we're certainly not there yet.
Rich, any final thoughts on Ron's question too? Or?
The only thing that I would add is you don't have to tolerate that 15% misclassification rate. You can always, once you have a defined number of people who have a suspected outcome, you can find the record and fully adjudicated. So I don't think you have to compromise there. Certainly for a lot of outcomes of interest, the codes aren't going to be that good, and we would insist on it no matter what.
All right. I'd like to thank our panelists for a great discussion. Thank you.